supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In a potentially groundbreaking ruling, a three-judge federal panel has struck down the state of Wisconsin's legislative district boundaries, saying they're so gerrymandered that they violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the analysis used in the Wisconsin case suggests that Pennsylvania's districts might also be ripe for a challenge.
Courts have been reluctant to scrap legislative boundaries based on which party they benefit, in part because it's hard to find an objective measure of gerrymandering. In the Wisconsin case, the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center developed an analytical method to measure how effective each party's voters are in a given legislative map. The center's Ruth Greenwood says in Wisconsin, Democrats were packed into a few urban districts and Republicans were sprinkled around so they had just enough to win lots of districts.
So that the Republicans will win all of the close districts and the Democrats will win districts by an overwhelming majority. If you then go through, that's basically a really inefficient distribution of Democratic voters, but a very efficient distribution of Republican voters.
The center developed an index for each map called its efficiency gap. Greenwood says they applied the analysis to nearly every state house election for the past 50 years and found Pennsylvania so gerrymandered that Republicans will control the House even in a year when Democrats do well statewide.
That's the hallmark of a Republican gerrymander. It doesn't matter if the vote swings one way or the other. You keep getting one side elected and having control of that chamber.
Pennsylvania Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman says the Democrats' problem isn't gerrymandering, it's demographics.
The seats they have are so overwhelming Democrat, but there's not much you can do about it because, in Philadelphia, there's only Democrats, where the seats that are more swing seats, the Republicans are winning.
There's currently no challenge to Pennsylvania's district map, though Greenwood says she's gotten some calls from the state asking about the idea. Meanwhile, the group Fair Districts PA wants to take redistricting out of the hands of legislative leaders, where it mostly resides now. Barry Kaufman of Common Cause Pennsylvania is a member.
We are working to try to achieve a nonpartisan commission, which is composed of people who are not politicians or lobbyists or party operatives.
That effort is stalled in the legislature. The Wisconsin case is likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
A lawsuit brought forth by an anonymous New Jersey transgender woman is fighting for the right to change her birth certificate. She wants to have it reflect her gender identity without undergoing gender reassignment surgery. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports.
Julie Chavanis, one of the lawyers representing the woman, says surgery should not be seen as the arbiter of a person's gender identity.
The main takeaway is that trans people are individuals and should be permitted to declare their own identity. The individual's desire is what's important here.
She says surgery is just one treatment option for trans people with gender dysphoria.
No requirement and no need for any treatments if, in fact, they're happy with where they are, if they're not distressed. It's not like that golden city on the hill.
For trans people who do want the surgery, health and financial barriers can also act as obstacles. Pennsylvania, New York, Iowa, and other states have all changed their birth certificate laws so that trans people do not have to undergo gender reassignment surgery to change their official government records. The plaintiff's lawyers are seeking a declaratory judgment request that would invalidate the existing New Jersey law for everyone in the state. The New Jersey Attorney General's office declined comment on the suit. For WHYY, I'm Ann Hoffman.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is looking to end a long-standing state program aimed at helping financially distressed cities. Lawmakers are pushing a bill that would renew a handful of them, including ones in Camden, Trenton, and Bridgeton. Details from WHYY's Joe Hernandez.
Urban enterprise zones are areas in primarily poor cities where businesses can make tax-free purchases and charge customers half the state sales tax. There are 32 of them in New Jersey. One is in Bridgeton in South Jersey. Mayor Albert Kelly says the so-called UEZ helped save the city from financial ruin.
Our downtown kind of bottomed out back in the late 70s. And the UEZ was a godsend to allow us to have a competitive advantage with the shopping centers that were going around the city of Bridgeton and in our neighboring cities.
The state assembly has already passed the bill. In the Senate, it's been referred to a committee. Back in September, Governor Chris Christie vetoed a broader reauthorization of the program. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Race relations in America played prominently in the minds of voters during the tumultuous presidential campaign, and the diversity of opinion will inform the incoming Donald Trump administration. A new book entitled Televised Redemption, Black Religious Media and Racial Empowerment Lends Historical Perspective on Changing Attitudes. Its co-author, John L. Jackson Jr., is professor and dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Dean Jackson, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I suppose the idea for this book long preceded this presidential campaign.
Absolutely. Academics notoriously take a long time to bring things to market, as they say. So I would even say it preceded Obama going into the White House. This was us trying to think for a long time about how to tell a story about religion that had almost existential and at least political consequences as well.
And it seems to work chronologically from present backwards through centuries.
Absolutely. So part of the point is to say academics are prone to doing this anyway, but we always want to place the present into its proper historical context. Like, how different is our contemporary religious world from the traditions of yore, and what do we learn from those discrepancies? And the book tries to tease that out a little bit.
So let's talk about the title and come to accord on terms, Black Religious Media.
Black Religious Media really means any number of ways in which African-Americans or African diasporic people. So we mostly talk about folks in the U.S., but I think it's, you know, relevant for people all over the world who use some mechanism to communicate their message. So one of the ways you know the book is relatively old is even the term televised, which now seems outmoded. And so for us, the whole point is to say there's something about how we communicate our religious beliefs that aren't simply about representing our relationship to a higher power, but it's always about translating our commitments as political subjects in the world. And the way we communicate that, even in religious context, tells us something about how we interact with others as civic participants in a larger body politic.
Though, as the book clearly delineates, there is no unity in the term Black religious media, and you look primarily at three different groups: Christian Prosperity Ministry, African American Islamic Consciousness, and Black Hebrew Israelites. How did you choose those subsets?
Straightforwardly, those are the three communities that the three authors, myself included, that we study. And so I have been working for over a decade now on Black Jews, Black Hebrews, Black Israelites, and really feeling like there's a story they tell, even in their atypicality, that other people should hear. And my co-authors, both Carolyn and Marla, work on Islam and Christianity, respectively, and have been doing that for a long, long time.
Well, then, as you broach it, let's focus first on your specialty. And as dean at the University of Pennsylvania, you tapped into data available at one of our colleagues, WURD.
Oh, absolutely. So really part of the point of a book about the Hebrew Israelites is to explain to people that even though when you look at their belief system, it might seem very unusual. So they talk about themselves as being adamantly anti-religious. So, you know, they would denounce any religious tradition, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, because they understand their relationship to what they would call the Most High, and the relationship even to sacred texts like the Old Testament to be about a cultural and national practice, not about a religious formation. And
anti-religious? Think atheist or think of a spirituality?
Exactly. So less atheism, more, and even not quite spiritualism. And this, for them, it's about thinking through a set of almost nationalistic commitments. And so for them, the Old Testament, they read it in a literalist way as a contract between the most powerful being in the universe and his chosen people. But for them, it's not about any of the trappings of organized religious formations.
So given that background, how do they further the conversation about racial empowerment?
In a nutshell, they do two things that I think are really powerful. One is they challenge our assumption about the relationship between blackness and spirituality. So people want to assume, especially in the U.S. context, that there's almost something organic about the links between African Americans and Christian traditions of various kinds.
I imagine there are very specific challenges, though, for African-American Islamic consciousness advocates in light of the political climate of this country post 9/11 and certainly in 2016.
And one of the ways we frame it is to think about this both in a post 9/11 context, but also in the context of a civil rights movement that was really fundamentally driven by this commitment to the Nation of Islam and this iconic figure like Malcolm X. And so what does Malcolm X mean in this post 9/11 moment, in this moment where we're talking about global terrorism in different language than we've ever used before? And so the book also shows us how folks across the world redeploy people like Malcolm X to make critiques of the U.S. state.
Even Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we lay out some of the ways in which all of these symbols of sort of racialized religious commitments in the U.S. can get re-energized and recirculated in unanticipated ways to do different kind of political work for people.
John L. Jackson, Jr., professor and dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author of the new book entitled Televised Redemption, Black Religious Media and Racial Empowerment. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. For many, the holidays are about recreating the familiar and following tradition. But for one local family, this holiday season is full of firsts. They were reunited after nearly 50 years apart. Paige Flager of our health and science team, The Pulse, has the story.
Keith Murphy is 52 now, but he still remembers the day decades earlier that changed his life.
Sitting at a kitchen table one day when I was around 16, my dad came in the door drunk, and he just went off on this wild tirade. And he proceeded to put his finger on my mother's face and said, "Why don't you tell him about Greg," is what he called him. And that was the very first time I found out that I actually had a brother.
Keith collected clues from his father's drunken episodes. Eventually, he pieced together the story behind his long-lost younger brother, a story that began on the day that Keith was born in 1964. Here's his mom, Nancy Oakes DeWitt.
Well, I was a 16-year-old unwed mother, living at home with my parents, madly in love with his father. Neither one of us young, old enough to get married, and if we could get married, and how would we support each other? And so I had Keith. I brought him home and raised him with my parents' help.
How did your parents react to that?
To Keith? Mm-hmm. Well, they were furious when I told him I was pregnant, but they loved him. I mean, and they helped raise him, and they were wonderful to him.
They were kind to him, but told Nancy that if she got pregnant again, they would take Keith away from her and send her to girls' reformatory school. And a few years later, she got pregnant again. She was scared, so she hid it for 9 months. The night of September 18th, 1966, Nancy went into labor in the backseat of her car. Her boyfriend, Patrick, who was just 17 at the time, delivered the baby himself. It was a boy. He cut the umbilical cord and tied it off with a shoelace. He then wrapped the baby in white towels and left him in a random car parked outside of a New Jersey bowling alley.
I've given away my baby. And it's a place I don't want to ever have to go through again. It doesn't get any easier with time.
Nancy didn't look at or hold the baby. She never told anyone. She and Patrick got married soon after and had two daughters and another son. But their life wasn't what she had expected it to be.
I never dreamed my life with Patrick and my other kids would be so hard.
This was one of the catalysts for his alcoholism, the guilt. My mom found religion, my dad found the bottle.
While his family was crumbling, Keith embarked on a search. He looked for police reports, adoption records, news articles, anything that might lead him to the brother that his parents had given up. But after decades of dead ends, Keith lost hope. Then, about a year ago, he got a strange notification from Ancestry.com. He had taken a DNA test in order to sort out his ethnicity and put together his family tree.
The results came in, and you look at the ethnicity at the top, and I'm like, okay, 65% British. You scroll down to your direct connections. And lo and behold, I found Scott Winter, 17, as a direct either sibling or grandparent. And just knowing that all my grandparents had passed away, it just basically meant that he was a direct sibling.
So he did what any self-respecting 21st century person would do. He stalked every single Scott Winter on Facebook, sending them all the same message.
Scott, my name is Keith Murphy. I'm looking for Scott Winter 17 from Ancestry.com. And I believe that if you are him, we are brothers.
Across the country in California, 49-year-old Scott Winter was having what he thought was going to be a pretty typical day. He woke up, got ready for work, and checked his Facebook. He had a message from someone named Keith Murphy. He read it and then checked his Ancestry.com account. Sure enough, there was a notification that said he had been matched with a brother.
And I remember standing, looking at my computer in disbelief for probably like 10 minutes going, you know, is this a trick? Is somebody playing with me? I mean, it took me about another 5 or 10 minutes to actually dial his number. I remember standing there, my hand was shaking. I finally dialed in his number and I didn't hit send for about another 10 minutes because I'm like, man, I got to be prepared for this. So
I still remember the very first phone call. I answered the phone. He goes, Keith. And I go, yes. He goes, this is Scott. And I said, oh, man, I was waiting for this phone call for all my life.
Keith and Scott discovered that they have a lot of similarities. They're both in sales, grew up in the same part of New Jersey, and share an obsession for shoes and peanut butter. The biggest difference between the two was the kind of life that they had growing up.
I know the childhood my children had, my four children that I had, and they did not have what you would call a normal childhood. And I was certain that Scott would have a more normal childhood than the other four. And to this day, I think he probably had the best childhood of any of them.
His adoptive parents are just amazing, amazing people. I mean, if you look at, like, who may have had the better upbringing, it's, you know, I think he won the lottery on that.
Scott had a happy life, but one of the most difficult parts of his childhood was all of the questions that he had when he found out he was adopted.
You know, do I have siblings, and what are they like? And, you know, with relation to your biological mother, I always wondered, you know, on key dates, you know, like birthday, Christmas, stuff like that, you know, is she out there thinking about me? Or, you know, just, you know, on one hand, you're kind of cast aside. So you always wonder, okay, am I at least in their thoughts?
These last 49 years, very painful. His birthday, Christmas. The first few years when you saw a little one running around that would have been his age, you always wondered, I wonder if that's mine. So, yes, it was very painful.
But this holiday season, 50 years after Scott was left in a car at a bowling alley, the family is reunited. Scott lives in California now, but when he last came into town, the family took the opportunity to celebrate together. Nancy and all of her children. Keith, Scott, and their younger siblings, Lene, Charles, and Jeanette. It was a full house.
You know, we had Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas yesterday. Our first one together.
So. All three in one day.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
It was a mess.
Look at the back. Oh, yeah. Well, the back.
I had Christmas in one section. Yeah. We had a Thanksgiving dinner. We had Halloween in another section. But, you know, it's like trying to make up for lost time. That can never happen.
They talk like this for a while, huddled together on a couch. This is only the second time that they've all been together, but they don't look like strangers. They look like family. For WHYY, I'm Paige Flager.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.